This is the Senate Committee on Labor, Consumer, and Business Affairs Committee on Hearing Room B at 1 o'clock p.m. on Monday, March 7, 1977.
First bill we're here today, including Senator Hannon, who must leave to another committee meeting soon. Senate Bill 429, which should extend the definition of public utilities for purposes of utility regulations to the head of generation distribution system. Senator Hannon?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Senate Bill 429 was introduced at the request of Mr. Al Blackford of Medford, Oregon. Mr. Blackford is a subscriber to cable TV service in Medford, and he had some difficulty with the local cable TV company. Through the efforts of his problem that he had with the cable TV company, he found out that there was no recourse of action that he could take. So he approached me and asked me for a request to introduce this bill and have it considered by this session of the legislature. Mr. Blackford just recently took his case to court in Medford and lost the case due to, a certain amount of misinformation that he had, apparently. But let me briefly describe what Senate Bill 429 would do. Senate Bill 429 would place the cable TV companies under the jurisdiction regulation of the Public Utility Commission in the state of Oregon. Rules and regulations would be adopted by the commission to control, maintain, establish rates, and thereby give the public a recourse in a sense of action against a complaint against the cable TV company. Currently in the state of Oregon, they are unregulated. There are cross-borders of different types of utility in the sense that it's not a metered utility like a power company or a gas company, but it is a utility, and it's been a concern of some people that live in subdivisions that have applied to cable TV companies and have not been able to obtain the service. This would help them in the means of securing a course of action. And I think it should be brought out right here that this bill does have implications as far as the cable industry is concerned. I'm sure that no business or utility, in essence, likes to have government regulations control their enterprise, but if they are going to function as a monopoly, in a sense, because they're operating in a franchise there, then they should therefore look to the area of coming under some type of control. So for that reason, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I have introduced Senate Bill 429. And I'm sure there's going to be speakers on behalf of the cable industry itself to address this measure. But I'd be glad to answer any questions that you might have. Is it already approved by cable TV? Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman, it is. It operates in, I'm not sure, four counties in Southern Oregon, part of Northern California.
From your experience, can you tell the committee of any abuses that you feel that exist as a result of this monopoly?
Mr. Chairman, I don't personally have any knowledge of abuses. I have a lot of complaints that have been brought to me by subscribers of the company. They would appear to be minimal complaints that perhaps could be worked out with the company if they
can give us an example of some of those
the complaints of you.
Well, are there ways from obtaining services in a subdivision area that the city and cable TV company was in dispute over jurisdiction of it right away and over the cost figures on who would be receiving the service?
Senator Crowe, Senator Hammond, do you know whether or not the cable companies are regulated at the national level?
They come under the jurisdiction regulation of federal communications.
Do you know to what extent that might, that kind of regulation would handle problems that would arise because of?
I think the essence of what you're saying is the further the control away from the people, the more difficult it is perhaps to deal with bureaucracy somehow.
Well, if we follow that line of reasoning, what about the local government control of the cable companies as they operate? The control you have when you issue the franchise and so forth. So, yeah.
Well, it's my understanding that some areas are currently in negotiations to obtain a franchise agreement with municipalities and the cable TV companies. Some of these things perhaps could be drafted into there.
But are you saying that local governments do not have the power to control the abuses that you're talking about?
It's a matter of local government does not have the ability to go to the cable TV company, for instance, if you have a complaint. It's either you go to the cable TV company and press them with your complaint, and if it's not resolved there, there's no request for it.
So what you're saying is there's absolutely a need for state action on this area?
I feel it there is.
Okay. Yes. I'd like to know the specific complaints that sparked this piece of legislation, because when you say that the kinds of complaints, general complaints that you received, and I take it wasn't particularly the one that caused this bill to be introduced, but related to subdivisions, it doesn't sound like that's necessarily something that's within the cable company's capacity to respond to. So I'd like to know what specific complaints. You don't have to get into their names and so forth, but what specific complaint is something that the cable company should have been able to deal with and wouldn't, and therefore trying to deal with them.
Let me give an example of the case of Mr. Blackford, and it was not until sometime after the Mr. Blackford had filed his case in court that I came to all the facts in the case. That give an example, in the city of Medford, the cable service Mr. Blackford's home was served off of a telephone pole system overhead line. Then there was a utility ordinance that was passed and adopted by the city, and the cable TV company went and installed the cable service underground. You know, the facts that I'm going to give up this corner are how they related to me by Mr. Blackford. Mr. Blackford then stated that the cable TV company came and addressed him and said that they were going to have to install this underground cable to his home, and asked if he wanted to be connected, and he said he did. They then cut through a portion of his water, underground water line, into his home, and Mr. Blackford approached the cable TV company about the damages. He said that he never did receive justified compensation. I don't know. These are the words that Mr. Blackford presented to me. Then the cable TV company came and disconnected the overhead service that was loaded into his home.
That was required to be done by the city, was it?
It was. And the underground service was connected to Mr. Blackford's home. He then received a subsequent bill
that stated that he was then a new customer and was charged a deposit fee for connecting on the new service. And this is a complaint.
A fee or a deposit?
The fee and a deposit.
How much is the fee?
I'm not sure. I stated something dollar wise, something around $45.
So was his complaint the broken water line or the fee?
I think there's a mixture of several things, and I would stress at this point that Mr. Blackford, and I've since come to find out since his case was taken to court, that Mr. Blackford is an 82-year-old man, and there was some misunderstanding on Mr. Blackford's part in regards to the cable TV company and what was expected of him. However, Mr. Blackford felt that he had a legitimate complaint against the cable TV company.
Did he take it to court?
He took the issue of putting the connection fee and deposit to court.
And did the court find that he already had a good case?
No.
And about the water line, did you have...
I don't know what the conclusion of that is then.
Okay, but... So, I'm still not left to do the question of where are the remedies or reasons for this bill. Do you have another example? And if you don't, I mean, I realize that there were other things that might prompt the bill, such as this general concern about the story and asking the court to have a hearing, but I wonder if there was a more specific one.
Another example would be the cable TV company has a policy that they will only put an underground utility in the new subdivision if there's so many customers signed up. And some people bought their home sites in a subdivision on the premise that cable TV was part of the subdivision pack.
Did they, in those cases, did they try to take recourse against the subdivider that still presented them with that information when they purchased the pack?
It's my understanding they have. And they also approached the city, and the city said this is a cable TV policy.
But it was the cable TV company was not involved in misrepresenting this.
No.
So it was actually a subdivision people that were responsible for that rather than the cable TV company. Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, thank you, Glenn.
Thank you, Chairman.
Our next witness, Don Paxson with the Oregon Cable Communications Association. Don? Is that Don or Dan?
Don. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, my name is Don Paxson. I'm president of Liberty Communications, Inc. We operate cable systems in a number of Oregon cities, including Bend, Corvallis, Albany, Levian, Sweet Home, Newport, Johnson, not Lincoln City.
Yeah.
We serve about 24,000 cable subscribers in Oregon, and we also operate KEGI Channel 9 in Eugene. I'm also speaking as president of the Oregon Cable Television Association, which is a trade association which most cable operators belong to. To start with, I'd like to say that we oppose Senate Bill 429. I'd like to add that we would not oppose it if we were not already overregulated. Both the FCC and the congressional committee of both houses of Congress agree to the fact that we're overregulated, and there have been some studies made to support this view to the extent that the Communications Act of 1934 is in the process of being revised with the plan that a new bill will be presented to Congress. Cable television is a business that started in Australia in 1939. There are about 92 systems in Oregon, serving about 175,000 subscribers in 187 different communities. The purpose of cable television basically is to receive the broadcast signals of television stations, process, amplify, transmit them through coaxial cable, and deliver them to television sets of subscribers. In a nutshell, cable television is a community antenna system. While there are a few places in Oregon where no television signals are available, in most areas it is possible for subscribers to receive signals from rooftop antennas. The cable may provide better signals and bring in additional stations. In some cases, it provides additional services such as FM, radio, weather information, and locally presented, locally originated programs. Because cable is attached to poles, if you're on the public street, cable operators must obtain franchises. It's a requirement in every city within the state of Oregon, every incorporated city. Because every community is unique, there is no single franchise that can be called a model. However, the customary cable franchise is a minimum, covers the following matters in considerable detail. First being that the city gives the cable operator the non-exclusive right to erect poles, install facilities on public streets, and specifying the rules under which this can be done, and the quality of workmanship that must be maintained in that operation. Second point is, return for this facility, the cable operator usually pays the city a 3% franchise fee. The city assumes control of the rates to be charged at the cable service and becomes the judge of whether the cable operator is providing a quality service to his subscribers. Complaint procedures, bonding and insurance requirements, use of access channels, and a host of other rules become part of the franchise document. The members of city councils are usually very familiar with cable service, generally subscribers. In any event, their constituents rarely hesitate to advise them whenever there is a problem on the cable. Operation of the cable system becomes a personal matter between each subscriber and his neighbor who is on the city council. Cable franchises are generally 20 or 30 pages long. I have a couple of them right here. They're very detailed. They cover virtually every aspect of operation of the cable system. If you'd like to see these, I'd be more than happy to make them a part of this record so that you do have some view of what normal city franchise cable regulation is all about. In addition to that, in 1972, the FCC, Federal Communications Commission, took jurisdiction over cable with a comprehensive set of rules. They overlap and to some extent preempt the local right to of cities to regulate cable television. These regulations also impose expensive reporting requirements and provide for certification of systems. They require every system to have a franchise. They cover signal codes, which means importation of distant signals, leapfrogging, technical standards, cable crossing, simultaneous exclusivity, movie rules, radio codes, channel capacity, construction standards, and just many, many other items. These regulations have had the effect of stifling the growth of cable television. Paperwork involved in carrying out provisions of these rules is truly overwhelming. The problem is further complicated by the FCC effort to re-regulate cable in partial recognition of the extent of the regulation which is imposed. The rules are in a constant state present of being changed, partially deleted, old rules being replaced with new rules. The rules as they currently exist, this is the setup, this is the rule under which we operate under at the federal communications level. I have here a partial list of the pending rulemaking dockets concerning cable television. There are 21 of these pending. There are an additional 17 petitions for rulemaking which are in the hopper but not yet introduced. In addition to that, during the last year, there have been 33 FCC actions concerning cable television. 33 separate docket numbers. It gives you some idea of the plethora of rules. In our case, we have hired an in-house attorney to help us keep on top of the rules, the rule changes, and to fill out the documentation required. The legal fees and the cost of regulation of cable television is indeed an enormous project for a very small industry. In addition to this set of rules, extensive reports are going to be required starting at the beginning of next year when cable television will for the first time be subject to copyright laws and the copyright law which was passed in the last Congress. Senate Bill 429 proposes to inject a third layer of regulation above the state, above the local, and above the federal regulation. And of course, the cable operator asks why. Why do we need it? It's a basic principle of our economic system that government should not interfere with free enterprise systems unless there is an overriding need to protect the public. And I thought maybe it might be useful to present just a few reasons why I think the PUC regulation would not be helpful in the regulation of cable TV. First of all, cable does not fit the traditional definition of a utility. It is not a necessity. It truly is a luxury. Unlike electricity, telephone, gas, and water, for which there are no substitutes, cable is subject to strong competition, not only from the television signals obtainable from rooftop antennas, but from other entertainment media, none of which is subject to regulation. Cable service is generally a discretionary expense. And experience has shown that when rates are too high, people disconnect. People simply don't describe or have their service connected if they feel that the rates are out of line. Cable is subject to far more regulation than at both the national and local levels than most businesses must contend with. There actually is no aspect of cable that the PUC would regulate, which is not already being regulated, either by the FCC or by your local officials. The imposition of regulation by the state on the cable business, and it's a small and relatively new business in terms of other businesses, would be discriminatory and is justified only if a strong showing of abuse or substantial public benefit is made. The PUC would have to develop a whole new field of expertise if they were to regulate cable television. PUC regulation would increase costs of regulation, which must be passed along really to the ultimate subscriber. These costs have been estimated at $145,000 during the next biennium and $190,000 the following biennium. These costs will have to be passed along to subscribers.
Pardon me, I didn't. What were those costs for?
$145,000 would be the cost, estimated cost of the regulation during the next.
To you, by the PUC. You'd be lucky to $145,000.
That's correct. This would be in addition to the franchise fees that are levied by the local municipalities and the fees which the FCC may impose. The FCC fees which have been imposed on the cable industry have been torn down by the court, and new legislation will be required before those fees can be reintroduced. Local governments assure that rates will not be increased for the purpose of adding to local service.
Let me ask you this. You mentioned local government. The only local government you mentioned is the cities.
That's correct.
The counties also have.
They have the right but to issue franchises. In the state of Oregon, they have not seen fit to do so.
I see.
But they have the right to do so, and in many areas they do so. It's a discretionary matter. Now, if a franchise is issued only to a county area, then that county would be required to have a franchise. But generally speaking, if the cable serves only, it does not serve rural areas.
Well, yeah. You have some urban areas outside the city limits that are quite heavily populated in Oregon that you must serve. Yeah. Are your rates higher outside the city than they are within the city?
It is a policy of our company, and I think it is a policy of most every other cable system, to have uniform rates within the area that they serve. And let's put it this way, if there were a discrepancy in this area, there would be the right of the county to step in and to provide that rate. It may be that some counties are in the DAC franchise in Oregon. I think I would stand corrected. There are some that do. There are none that issue franchises to our company. Continuing on, with your cities involved in the rate issues, you have a very interesting situation if the PUC organization were to regulate cable television. Take Bend, for example, which is the system that we operate. city has decided to increase rates $2 to pay for a microwave system across the Cascades to improve service in the Bend area. This is a discretionary decision, and would the PUC be comfortable in levying a $2 per month rate to improve service? That's a discretionary decision that is made by that community. And it would be very difficult, I think, for a statewide organization to come to grips with what would be a purely local matter. Cable television is a really small business. As I mentioned, there are 92 systems in Oregon. Only 15 of these systems have 2,500 subscribers or more. Many neighborhood gas stations have a larger monthly revenue than a system with that number of subscribers. Cable competes with rooftop antennas and 221 translators. The fact is there are few areas in Oregon where less than 3 operator signals can be received, either by translators or directors from the TV stations themselves. It is our understanding that Senate Bill 429 was introduced at the request of a single individual. I think it's fair to state that any business serving 175,000 customers is going to have an occasional disagreement with a customer. Cable operators for many years have had the policy of undertaking their own investigation complaints, which were brought to their attention, and this policy has resolved a number of the disputes. As far as we can determine, only 18 complaints have reached the state PUC level during the last year. If there were thousands or even hundreds of complaints, this would be some evidence that legislative action would be desirable. But there's no such evidence that really has surfaced. Proponents of state regulation may argue that the PUC will improve the quality of service. Technical standards for cable television have been preempted. You also have the question
at home. Pardon? They're preempted by the Fed?
By the federal government. Right. There's been a question raised that the PUC regulation would allow a forum for people to register complaints. The FCC rules require that each city have a complaint procedure for the handling of individual complaints by customers. And that system must be part of the franchise procedure. Finally, I'd just like to say that we really see no need for this legislation. And we certainly urge the committee to vote no. If you have any questions of me, other than what have been raised already, we're happy to answer them. We'd like to be of whatever help we can, and certainly we feel that it is important for us, for you to understand the cable television business, because in understanding it, I think you really must consider the fact that the regulations that we have already are set, but this PUC regulation just does not have the need.
I wonder if I could ask you a question. Basically, what do you do to keep the rates down as low as possible so that you can provide service for as many people who need it.
You operate your business as efficiently as you can.
Mm-hmm.
You have as few people as you can. Consistent with what would be considered a good public, providing a good public service. There's a trade-off.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, when there is a complaint, you have to be prepared to handle that complaint.
Mm-hmm.
So most every system has a 24-hour system of providing service with an answering service arrangement during the late hours.
Yeah. What I'm asking about is the rates that you charge per month, the monthly rate, and how, how do you keep the price down on that? Let me ask you to follow up on that. How about the variance of rates from place to place, so over the state where we have cable? Do the rates vary tremendously from one place to another?
Yes, they vary, and that depends on the level of service. As I mentioned in Bend, the city there has decided that rather than rely on a microwave system which was installed on CD Butte, that they would like to eliminate the third condition and have that microwave sent clear across to the valley so that those signals can be...
How much variance in range do you have? What's the lowest amount somebody's paying? What's the highest?
Probably $5 a month would be the very lowest. Doubt that they aren't even that low, but they may be.
And what are they paying as the highest?
I think the highest would be about $10.
Oh, I see. And why would somebody be paying $10? What factors would enter into that to make it so expensive?
Those systems that are in that range are very small systems,
mm-hmm.
Where there is much scattering of homes, and where you have some economies of scale.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have 150 subscribers, mm-hmm. You're still going to take a technician. It's going to be an expensive project to operate.
Mm-hmm.
And in some areas, and where you have few homes per mile.
How do Oregon's rates, average unit rates in other states, comparable states, are they about the same, or higher, or lower, or what?
I think they're a little lower.
Are they? Mm-hmm. Why would that be true?
Well, there are two reasons. I think the first one has to do with the cost of construction. In Oregon, it has not been as high. And really, your initial cost of a cable system, it's a very capital intensive business, and those initial costs are very high.
Mm-hmm.
And our costs here have not been as high. It's not as expensive for us to build a system in Oregon as we would find it to be in other areas. And that really has to be the main reason. Labor rates are less here than they are in some states, particularly in more urbanized areas.
That being the case, once a system is in place, should the rates then stay about constant year after year, or do you expect that they will increase gradually?
Well, they'll increase gradually because, first of all, you've got obsolescence of your plant, and it has to be replaced.
Mm-hmm.
Most of the new construction that you get now is underground construction. And that's much more expensive to build. So you've got to keep up with the progress of the individual town as it grows, and that's expensive to do. But those are two reasons.
Yeah.
Okay,
thank you very much.
Any further questions? With that, thank you. Our next witness is...
Hello,
St. Marie.
Dale.
Dale?
Yeah.
Okay, Dale.
Mr. Stone and Smitty.
How do you do?
Ladies and gentlemen. I'm a very small cable operator from Gold Beach, Oregon. I think Mr. Tyson has been very well given better testimony. The same rules apply to me as it applies to him. I have the same franchises to go through, the same FCC regulations. And I do it at a much smaller scale. I only have 665 subscribers in a 1,650 population area. So,
you get the signal from down in California?
We do get California signals, and we get Oregon signals.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You have a small operation, you said. Does that mean that your rates are high because you have a small operation?
Negative. I'm a, what they call a one-man operation. I do everything except the secretarial work.
Mm-hmm.
We have all rates. Excuse me. It's my first time at this. Our rates were $5 per month until the first of this month, and I went to the city council and got raised $1
mm-hmm.
without any complaints from any customer.
Why did you feel you needed to raise them?
I spent more last year than I made.
Plus, he was working 18 hours a day instead of 8.
You're not working for the minimum wage.
Well, I think we do fall into public category.
Any other further questions?
I'm afraid to ask.
Because he's afraid to ask you an answer.
All right.
Thank you very much, Dale.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. That will conclude the hearing on 429, and from there we'll go to. That's the 269. To lead off, we are fortunate to have with us Paul Romaine with the Justice Department, Consumer Protection Division. Paul Romaine is here tonight here, and then next is Tom Donahue with the Association of Oregon Industries. Tom isn't here.
Are you fortunate to have you here?
With the United Financial Lobby. Is he here? Not here?
It's Paul.
Very funny. We might as well adjourn, and none of us are here.
Paul is
Paul. I'm sorry, Paul.
Hey, Congress. It is getting rather warm in here, and we decided it was June for a second.
You wouldn't thaw, but it wouldn't warm up.
Well,
for the record, my name is Paul Romaine. I'm Chief Counsel of the Consumer Protection Division of the State of Oregon Department of Justice. I believe Connie's passing out our amended Senate Bill 269, and I would hope that the committee would refer to that in discussion and not to the original bill. The original bill has been fairly well
mutilated,
gutted. I don't know exactly the term.
Is this a complete bill now?
This is a complete bill as what we are proposing. Now, let me tell the committee ahead of time that there's been a number of meetings on Senate Bill 269. There is a pretty much general agreement on what should and should not go into 269 by the various interest groups. There is one or two areas of disagreement, and I'll point them out to the committee, probably at the end of the testimony. But what I'd like to do is run the committee through Senate Bill 269 as amended, dated March 7, 1977. The major changes in the existing law are, number one, to ensure, we're not sure whether we have jurisdiction over rentals and leasing now, but to ensure that we do have jurisdiction, and we believe that we do, but we want to be more specific on it, we wanted to put in rentals. So that the change in on page 1 is in subsection 1, the substantive change, and that includes rental, so that would make sure that we have jurisdiction over rental and leasing.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator Carson.
Paul,
I apologize, maybe there's the heat getting to me. That just doesn't make it clear. It doesn't make any sense. It's already a difference. So trade and commerce means advertising, offering, or distribution, whether by sale. Wouldn't it be distributing?
That was existing law. Yeah, we can change
it. Well, yeah, but without offering for sale,
right.
Sale or distribution.
We can put in distributing.
Yeah.
Well, it's a substantial change. It's what we're trying to get at is any way of conveying property. What Senator Carson is talking about is in the second line on subsection one. Changing distribution to distributing. I've read this bill 12 times and I know what it says to me, but I don't know what it says
what
to
you. What are you offering or distributing, though?
Right.
Well, you know, so it says, trade of commerce means advertising, offering, or distributing what?
Whether by any real estate goods or services.
Okay, then it goes out any
real estate goods.
That is the major the change, aside from where I thought were all grammatical mistakes on page one.
And what's otherwise mean?
It's our intent to get any form of conveyance of property, real estate goods or services, any form of distributing it. We don't know if there's other means of distributing property besides sale, rental, leasing. There might be. The intent is to include all types of taking property and getting it to somebody else.
Otherwise, is a good legal term?
It's a pretty legal term. It's all inclusive, and that's what we intended.
Under the consumer voice, is under the consumer protection division.
Right. These are amendments to the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which is enforced by the Consumer Protection Division of the Department of Justice. There's also a private right of action in that particular act.
Rentals involved in that, home rentals involved in that before?
Home rentals has never been, and that's one of the disputed issues. Our office is taking absolutely no position on that, and I was going to point that out at the end of my testimony, Senator.
I was going to ask for some protection from your department for the landlord.
Our office does not go after landlords. If something falls within the residential landlord-tenant law, we normally send it over to either Wanda Merrill or refer it back to a private attorney. There will be people here testifying or asking you to exclude anything covered by the residential landlord-tenant law from this act. We have no objection to that, but we are not proposing it, whatever difference that makes. Now, on page 2, if you look at subsection 7, you'll notice that we have taken out from the original Senate Bill 269 the terms loans and extensions of credit. The intent here is to, when we first put in Senate Bill 269, you recall the problem that I brought to your attention concerning conversion of sales contracts by loans by a finance company. We have decided that page 2 of the amended version, it's not there. Subsection 7.
It's just not there.
I wanted to explain that we have taken it out. And why.
You don't have to explain. You're really confusing us.
If I don't explain, I'm going to have about 50 people in the back of the room who are yelling at me.
Oh.
So I have to explain. I want to mention a court case to satisfy everybody here. We talked with the superintendent of banks, Mr. Owen. We are convinced, or at least not convinced otherwise, that his office can handle the situation that we described to you and is willing and able to handle it in the future. So we have decided that we would be referring all cases involving loans and extensions of credit to Mr. Owen's office for the next few years, and if we feel that there's any problems that still exist 2 years from now, we will come in with possible amendments. But what we have done is we have taken out our asking for jurisdiction over loans and extensions of credit. Now, under the existing case of Hager versus Johnson, in the spring of 1976, our office was told by the Oregon Court of Appeals that we have no jurisdiction over loans and extensions of credit by whomever they're made. So that includes banks, savings and loans, finance companies, everybody. We have no jurisdiction over loans and extensions of credit, and it's not covered by the Unlawful Trade Practices Act.
Are you saying then that this bill really excludes financial institutions from coverage?
No, I'm not saying that.
Okay. What do you say?
Now, there are a few financial institutions that would like that. What there are other areas. We are excluding one major business, which is loans and extensions of credit.
Okay.
There is another bill which will probably be up in this committee shortly, and some in this bill, concerning collection practices, debt collection practices.
That isn't what we're wanting to get at. So the problem you alluded to when you first testified before this committee.
Right, right. But what we are doing is we're leaving open that area. And we also have a part in here on collection practices, unconscionable tactics.
So financial institutions are excluded except
their
collection area of the bill.
If they're acting pursuant to any form of state regulation, state law, federal law, they're excluded from coverage generally. There's a general exclusion.
Then you're referring just to a collection agency.
Pardon?
Then you're referring just to a collection agency.
But what we are trying to do is make sure that we leave open, if we don't get it in this bill, coverage of collection practices, which is collection of a debt. Now, if a finance company makes a loan, in the making of the loan, we have no jurisdiction. However, there is a section in here under unconscionable tactics that if they use unconscionable tactics in collecting that loan, then we have jurisdiction over that if this bill passes.
But you would have no jurisdiction over an instance that you told about where they added on to a contract to a loan and it would give you no
jurisdiction over that. We understand
the superintendent of banks does have that jurisdiction, or will have that jurisdiction.
Right. No, the superintendent of banks does have the jurisdiction now over making the loan. There's been no problem with that. We went over the law with him. We believe that he has, at this present time, adequate statutory authority. Now, the problem that we have is that in actual collection of that obligation, there is really nobody out there that regulates that. The real estate division has a collection agency division which regulates conduct between merchants and the collection agency. They're not businesses.
What about the superintendent bank has jurisdiction over a situation that you originally wanted this bill to cover, a certain situation regarding a loan that cost, there was tremendous finance charges, add on renewing a loan for the purpose of they could even charge this borrower more.
Right. They do have jurisdiction over that situation. We made a couple of
know that. You do?
No, they do. We do not.
Who are in the banks?
Who are in the banks?
Do we have the law enough? Do we have enough in the law now where he can enforce that?
Yes, and we're not suggesting that we put anything new in Senate Bill 269 concerning it. We think that he has enough jurisdiction now.
What has been the problem, and why hasn't he been enforcing this? Why wasn't this called to his attention? The Attorney General's office, I suppose they received this complaint. Why didn't they refer to it in the banks if he had that jurisdiction?
The problem was, at the time, there were two problems. Number one, this is what I had been told. I was not in the office at the time. I've come in since January. The superintendent of banks supposedly does have jurisdiction. the attorney that was handling it told me that he had referred the complaint over to the superintendent of banks, and superintendent of banks had done nothing about it. Superintendent of banks said that he did not recall ever receiving the complaint. I re-queried the attorney, and he is not sure whether it was that one or a similar one earlier that he sent over. So there's confusion in my statement to you now is that it probably was not sent over to the superintendent of banks. He agrees that he would do something. We had a meeting with the superintendent of banks, with a lobbyist for the finance companies, and we agree with him that he does have enough authority now to do something.
Well, knowing John Oldham, I'm sure he would do something about it if it were called.
I agree. He is powered by, we believe, by making rules to cover loans covering any circumstance, and that includes flipping and the practice we brought to your attention. Now, again, the thing I wanted to reiterate is loans and extensions of credit are not covered by this bill. Okay. Now half the room can leave.
Everybody, you can leave now.
Yes. But you're saying that what is showing is the rental or leasing in addition to sales.
Right. Sales, rental, and leasing, all that. Now, again, the point I made to Senator Groner is that there are people here that will ask you to exclude residential landlord tenant law from things covered by the residential landlord tenant law from the coverage of this act. We, as a practice, refer all those out. We don't handle those in our act.
But the law tells the union as opposed to what the general practice is.
Under present law in Multnomah County, the court has been interpreting it to not cover, to not allow a private right of action for residential landlord-tenant law, but rental problems under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act.
Can you say then that this bill will not apply?
No. The way it's amended, it will apply unless the committee decides to exclude residential landlord-tenant law.
I understand there will be a further testimony that will.
It will. Now, one thing I want to reiterate is our office is not taking any position on whether or not that should or should not be. As a matter of practice, we do not handle that. Now, if the committee chooses to exclude it, then you won't.
It's true. Since it's your bill, you're obviously taking a stand because your bill includes it.
Senator, we had a meeting of all types of lobbyists on this bill, legal aid, myself, business community, and what we decided was to present a bill that most everybody agreed on, agreed on most of the points, as many points as could be ironed out, and present to the committee any policy differences and options that could be voiced. Now, if the committee decides to exclude, it's very simple to put in an exclusion for a residential landlord-tenant. All we're presenting you with is a vehicle that's in reasonably good shape for any type of amendment that you want to make. Now, subsection 8 on page 2 has in unconscionable tactics. Now, we have redefined unconscionable tactics to take care of a couple of objections that were voiced by putting in, on page 3, paragraph B, knowingly permits a customer to enter a transaction. In paragraph C, there was a potential problem with student loans when somebody makes a student loan. Well, number one, it probably wouldn't be covered by, they wouldn't be covered by the act anyway. But there was a chance, if it was covered by the act, can a student pay it back when it's made? We put in when due. We're trying to take care of most of the objections that people had to that language. Now, the definition of unconscionable tactics, I will come back to in a little bit. In 608, which is the meat of our law, the prohibitions on certain conduct, the changes, substantive changes, begin on page 6. There are two. Paragraph F is a reiteration and clarification that we do have jurisdiction over advertised pricing. Now, we assume that we do. We've been acting since 1971 that we do. This is a clarification. Most of our work is containing advertised pricing, and this is pretty much the meat of consumer protection. P is failure to disclose a known material defect or material nonconformity. We have general agreement from the Merchants Association, AOI, and the automobile dealers that they have no objection to that. Now, if you will go on to page 7, you will see that section 3 adds section 4 to the series 605652, which is the Unlawful Trade Practices Act. And it says that it is another unlawful trade practice to engage in unconscionable conduct. The reason that is set out is a separate section to say that that provision is only enforceable by the Attorney General's office and is not enforceable by a private right of action. There is a later section of this bill, which you'll see, that gives a private right of action for any conduct that violates 646-608. To make sure that this unconscionable conduct, which can possibly lead to a lot of lawsuits that will be semi-ridiculous, is not abused. We've placed it only in the Attorney General's power. That's not to say that we won't abuse it periodically, but...
You're talking about Section 4?
Section 4, right.
Yeah. You talk about unconscionable conduct, but here the word is tactic.
Unconscionable tactic, and I believe it's
really defined as conduct.
I believe it's defined as tactic. It's defined as tactic. I'm using conduct, but it's unconscionable tactic.
And tactic is a good strong word.
Yes.
May I ask a question on that, Mike?
Sure.
We're going back to page 3 and then on C. The next question was to enter into a transaction of knowledge. I would think that I just don't see how that can be a tactic. That would be the fellow's recourse if you knew that the person couldn't accept when it was used.
Yeah, for instance, there are people, and I can't cite a specific example on it, but for instance, selling of an appliance. It is possible to sell an appliance 3 or 4 times, to sell it, get a down payment, know that this person's not going to be able to continue, go out and grab it. And that's basically what we're trying to get at. Now, on page 11 of the bill, page 10 and 11, you have section 9, which is amendments to the private right of action statute that exists in the unlawful trade practice law now. In subsection 2 on page 10, and going over to page 11, this change in subsection 2 has already been passed by the Senate in Senate Bill 218. It's merely a continuation of that. I hate to use the word housekeeping. I've been warned against it. But there is a requirement in the law now that the clerks of the court send us copies of all complaints and judgments and whatever, and they hate that. And what we wanted to do was put the burden on the plaintiff to send it, but make sure that did not prohibit them from bringing an action. They would have to make sure we got the material before they could enter the judgment. But
how will the party know that they are to mail a copy of the complaint for other initial pleading to the Attorney General?
It's part of the existing law, the same way that they know that they have a right of action if they read the law.
Does any individual know, I mean, if they bring action, they know that they are supposed to mail a copy, or is the court, who mails that copy?
Well, any
work of the court.
Before you bring an action, I would think that most people would read the sections that pertain to that action, and they'd find out just how you have to go about bringing the action. There's different procedures that you must go through, and that this statute sets out the procedures that you have to go through to bring a private right. Subsection 3 on page 11 is an attorney fee provision, which our office goes along with, and I believe legal aid goes along with. There are complaints from merchants that frivolous actions are being brought by people under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and that they're being held up saying that you cannot, if it costs you $400 to open up a file to defend the action, and you know it's frivolous, you might as well settle for $200 rather than costing $400. So what we have done here is given a merchant who feels that he has been hit by frivolous action a chance to fight back. If the action is frivolous, the merchant should have recourse. There is additional recourse potentially for a malicious prosecution, but this at least gives the merchant a club to fight with if an action is frivolous.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Senator Roberts?
Is there a similar provision in other kinds of cases, and has it been difficult to show whether the action was frivolous or not?
It's not going to be easy to prove that the action is frivolous at all.
The burden of proof is on the defendant,
and he'll have to plead that the action is frivolous, and then the court will decide whether or not it is frivolous. It's not an easy section. It's not prevailing parties. It's frivolous action. We did not want to make it real easy because we did not want to disturb what amounts to legitimate consumer suits. What this does do, though, is give the merchant a handle, a way to fight back, at least in the negotiation stage, to say that if you do bring this action, we've tried to fix your car 45 times, we've been bending over backwards to save you. We think we fixed it. If you bring this action, we're going to plead that it's frivolous and go after you for attorney's fees. And I believe that they do have a right to, in a situation like that, to fight back. And I found nobody that disagrees with that, including other consumer groups that we've talked to. Of course, everybody believes that they don't bring frivolous actions. And if you turn to page 13, one final amendment, that's inclusion of an amendment to 83820. What this does is, if you recall, one of the evils that we pointed out in the conversion problem that I brought to your attention in the original practice was that the person who was converted, whose sales contracts were wiped out and a loan put in, has now lost defenses that they might have. For instance, if that washing machine breaks while they're paying for it under the sales contract, they can stop payment and demand that the washing machine be fixed under certain circumstances. If they take a sledgehammer to it, then they can't do it. But if it just breaks, just quits on them. They have certain warranty protections. What this does is make sure that in in-house conversion, a flipping situation, that those warranty rights still exist, at least as long as the person would have had them had they kept the sales contract. And that was the intent of the amendments. The amendments are really on page 15, the amendments to 83820. Now, again, the areas of disagreement, I believe, are the landlord-tenant area, and I believe you'll have testimony on that. And I believe there might be some people who want to exclude financial institutions of all types from the bill. There's been no agreement on that, and I oppose it.
Exclude who?
Financial institutions of all types from the bill and whatever practices they go into. We do want jurisdiction over collection practices, no matter who engages in collection practices. We need the jurisdiction over them. There's an awful lot of out-of-state collectors. Most of the in-state collectors are reasonably good collectors. We have surprisingly very little problem with them. But an awful lot of the out-of-state collectors give us an awful lot of problems. And we feel that we should have jurisdiction over that. And those are basically the areas that you might hear testimony on. I'll be staying around to ward off attacks or whatever on the bill.
Yeah, but we'll probably use you. We appreciate you.
But I believe that the Senate Bill 260
committee member of the committee. Yes.
Thank you, John. You mentioned that the loans from banks and other lending institutions are not going to be covered anymore. And partly because the banking commissioner has jurisdiction. Do they have any kind of unconscionable language in there? Legislative jurisdiction.
I'm sure there's a lot of people here who would say that they have a lot of unconscionable language in their statute, but they don't have the specific unconscionable conduct language. What they do have, what the superintendent of banks does have, is jurisdiction over loans generally, and making of loans. You can the tactics used in making loans you can control by rule. And we've been over this with John Olin, and I believe that he will, if called to his attention, will go after these practices. Perhaps our office did not call it to his attention, I can't say for sure. We will be calling every one of them to his attention from here on out. And I can assure you that if we feel that the practice still exists 2 years from now, where something like that is being taken advantage of, that will come in and ask for a change in legislation. But I believe that he should be possibly given the staff or the chance to do it.
Could you answer my question now?
He doesn't have any language about unconscionable conduct.
What means can the superintendent of banks take to punish an offender such as the one you related to us a couple, 3 weeks ago? Can he suspend or revoke a license, for example, for the savings and loans?
The problem is, the thing I related to you 3 weeks ago, he couldn't do anything right now. What he has power to do is pass rules to prohibit any or all of those specific practices that we're engaged in. He cannot, under existing rules that he has right now, do anything on that. What he could do, he has a lot of informal pressure. For instance, if somebody comes in for a new branch license or something, he could do something there. He'd be walking the line of
one of new branches. So.
He has informal pressure available to him right now. The thing that he does have is rulemaking authority right now to prohibit by rule any of those specific practices. Now, some of those practices that I brought to your attention in that particular instance were outrageous. They were very outrageous. Conversion, though, in some business sense, is fairly decent. For instance, somebody comes in and has 25 sales contracts, has bought a whole household, bunch of household furniture, and cannot make the monthly payments. Well, somebody extends their loan out over a longer period of time and gives them monthly payments that they can make, then that might be a decent conversion, as long as they still had their warranty rights. which this bill does give to them. The problem was, in that instance, that the loan was not extended out over any greater period of time. The interest rate was raised tremendously. The monthly payments were raised. There was no rational basis for the loan in the first place. And the commission, the superintendent of banks can, by rule, prohibit situations like that.
Senator Cole?
Couple questions, Paul. As far as you know, has the superintendent of banks made such rulings to prohibit
No.
Such, do you know why he hasn't made them?
No. I don't know. I would imagine that he has not had any of this activity called to his attention. Now,
does he know about, that's another question, does he know about unconscionable acts like this because there's no, as you say, there's nothing in the statutes that would suggest that he should be alert to these things. So do we know that he's handling the problem?
Well, he's alert to, or should be alert to, acts that are unconscionable that might come across. He has the power to go in and audit a financial institution. If during his audit he sees that a finance company is making engaging in that practice that I described last time in a great amount, or even one or two of them or whatever, he can at that point say, by rule, pass a rule that says, no, you can't do this. Or he could now, without even just thinking that that practice might exist, pass a rule saying, or controlling conversion.
But we don't know. As far as you're concerned, you don't know whether he's all that much concerned about all this and whether he is acting in this area.
I have no reason to doubt that he's not concerned about it. I met John Owen for the first time after my testimony, and he impresses me as being a very honest and vigorous enforcer.
I'm not satisfied with the bill as it is, and I'm not satisfied with the answers as far as the authority of the superintendent of banks is concerned, and I think either you have to have rulemaking powers or something in the statutes to take care of the situation you alluded to in previous testimony. So I'm going to ask, we still have further witnesses, but I'm going to ask the Senator Wires if he would work, and I'd like the superintendent of banks, take care of the superintendent of banks, and probably some of the bankers, Frank Bronner and savings alone, and see if we can't work something out there.
Chairman?
Yes.
I think that's beyond my experience and expertise. I really do.
I've had a great experience for you, and I would appreciate it if you would. It would be, it's something I feel that gained some expertise in, and I think that if you would meet with the superintendent of banks, I think you have a point there. As far as the rulemaking authority of the superintendent of banks is concerned, there's nothing in this bill to take care of the situation, as far as I know, that you alluded to. Or the superintendent of banks doesn't have that authority, according to your testimony.
No, Senator, if I may.
Without rulemaking authority, unless he has a rule.
According to my reading of his statute, he has rulemaking authority. He has no rules right now, but he needs to promulgate the rule.
We need someone to prod him to promulgate. That's what Senator Wires making. It was your suggestion.
I knew that question was rather brief. I thought I was right.
Any further testimony? If not, our next witness, and thank you, Paul. And the next witness is Tom Donahue with the AOR.
Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Donahue, and I'm here today speaking for our Oregon Retail Council Division. We've reviewed the amendments that have been to the bill that have been proposed to you by the Attorney General's office. We've reviewed them. I think we can work with them. I think we understand them. Therefore, as far as we're concerned, the bill is in shape
as it is.
As it is. There are, with the proviso that another one of the colleagues on my staff does have an objection, which Mr. Romain alluded to, which has to do with landlord-tenant law. So This is on behalf only of the Oregon Retail Council.
Okay.
So any thank you. Any
questions? Tom? Thank you. Thank you. And Tom Hooten with what? Weyerhaeuser.
You're on
the... I'm sorry. Dave Barrows. I just got this line on the wrong seat. Dave Barrows with a United Financial Lobby.
Dave
Barrows not here. We'll go to George. Well, let's go to Jack Monroe with the Oregon Association of Realtors.
Advertisement for rental
the case may be subjective terms. Now I thought, well, perhaps there are others. It might be related more like to the bait and switch kind of thing when you say, what's really, you know, three bedroom apartment with view, and you go out there and view is of a garbage dump, and then.
Yeah,
and it's less serious for whom is a good question, and maybe the person takes it. But in that situation, it would seem unlikely. I mean, it's obviously the law was not really drawn up with originally with rental in mind, and some of the parts of it don't seem to, you know, really be germane to rental. But I wondered if there were.
Well, to be specific, to respond specifically to your question. There is not, to my knowledge, any provision in the Residential Landlord Tenant Act that would cover an advertising problem. However, I don't think that the exclusion, which excludes only those interests covered by that act, would preclude the possibility of an unlawful trade practices cause of action based on advertising.
Okay.
The only difference is a fine of $250, I believe, in this bill, as far as the landlord of violation, certain violations of the landlord. There's no, I don't believe there's a fine in the landlord tenant.
The basic, there are specific remedies in the landlord tenant act that go to, in one hand, terminating the agreement. In other situations, being providing self-help remedies, the basic remedy under the Residential Landlord Tenant Act is directed toward making the tenant whole.
But under the unfair trade practices,
punitive damages and whatnot. You're absolutely correct.
Any further questions, Senator?
Mr. Romero, do you know why the Attorney General's office sought to include the realtors under this coverage?
Well, real estate, the language relating to real estate has been in there for some time. I think it would be accurate to say that the language in trade and commerce and the specific reference to rental and otherwise, and you asked the question about otherwise earlier. I think it's best language because of a court case, and I believe that court case is Harvey versus Johnson in a 1976 case. I don't know the subject or the substance of that case, but if I understand Mr. Romain correctly, it casts some cloud as to their jurisdiction in that general area. And it was their intent, at least, to clarify in some sense by putting that wording in here. I don't think, as Mr. Romain has suggested to you, his department has no specific feeling about that particular, about residential landlord tenant situations, and that's why they're taking that neutral position he indicated. They would neither intend to, if I understand correctly, not intend to involve themselves in that field. So with those questions,
I would like to have Mr. Romain respond eventually also to this particular question.
Senator Roberts?
Yeah, just to clarify, you would still have under this bill included those individuals who are renting real estate where it's not a residential situation, am I correct?
Exactly.
In other words, it would apply to, say, commercial rental.
And I think that, again, Mr. Romain and others should speak to that point, as you would know, Mr. Roberts, the residential landlord tenant law does cover only those dwelling units that are devoted to residence purposes. So you're quite right. It would cover commercial leases or commercial rental situations.
And that would include a temporary kind of like, let me rent this site to sell Christmas trees and this kind of thing also. would be still included, isn't it?
It certainly would not be excluded by the suggested amendment that I proposed.
Just that we made such a good amendment, would that pretty much remove the Attorney General office from the operation in this area? Would he, I guess I can't articulate this as well as I should, but would he be then his office not really involved in enforcing unconscionable tactics and so forth with regard to real estate?
Well, the Unlawful Trade Practices Act provides, you know, two basic forms of relief, if you will. There's the Attorney General enforcing his powers, and then there's the private right of action. In response to your question, with the proposed change, yes, the Attorney General would not be involved in those rental situations dealing with real property. Again, dealing with a specific form of real property residence, the
would this mean then that if we did this, his power to be involved would be decreased over what it is now?
Right now, to my knowledge, the Attorney General has never been involved in this particular area of the law. I mean, you know, he's never dealt in matters having to do with what would basically be the presidential and the tenant law, or areas covered therein. I don't know. Quite frankly, I can't speak to the question of whether or not the Attorney General's office really has involved themselves in any of the real property rental lease situations. To my knowledge, they certainly don't in the residential field. I mean, whether they have in those commercial dealings, I think they can't respond.
Why again is it then you want the amendment?
Well, I simply, Senator, I'm suggesting to you that in almost universal math, you, for example, bring contending that you have a cause of action both under the residential landlord tenant law and under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, and motion to strike is almost universally acceptable because of the specific remedies, the specific obligations and remedies in that act with regard to rental property, residential rental property. And I just think that clarification ought to be in this law. I don't think really you ought to expose or you would want to expose residential landlords to the possibility of being exposed to a combination of liabilities or considered the conflicting liabilities in both laws.
The residential landlords are generally just little people.
Since you've gone on diet.
Right. Any further questions? Senator Wyatt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The Residential Landlord Tenant Act involves primarily a private right. Isn't that correct, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Senator.
And Mr. Romaine testified that the private right had been removed from the amendment to this bill that we have before us today.
With regard to the unconscionable.
With regard to the unconscionable.
Right.
And because one of the reasons he did was that was to prevent a lot of lawsuits that were verging on ridiculous or something.
I think he's probably said for years or something similar, right?
Do you agree with that thinking about removing private rights from the bill in 269?
Yeah. Again, my concern was with the residential situation and not with the
with some data, because it is, you know, as a record as a proposed bill. But I would venture to say that because of the, I guess the broad definition found in the constable section, that again, I would have to support Mr. Romaine's suggestion that the Attorney General is the proper party to bring an action under this particular section, and that excluding the Colorado action would be the best course to pursue.
Well, how do I make consistent in my mind the taking the unconscionable private right for unconscionable tactics out of 269 and putting the Attorney General in, and not, because it will avoid frivolous or I think you said verging on ridiculous lawsuits, and then keeping the Attorney General out of the residential landlord-tenant type situation, and pushing it into the private right. It seems like it's running both directions at once.
I think that I think that we're dealing with fair opportunities in one sense. The unconscionable, the language relating to unconscionable, unconscionability, unconscionable tactics is found in the suggested act. We never intended to be directed toward, or I don't presume it was intended to be directed toward, rental real property transactions.
Well, there's an unconscionability definition in the rental real property.
A specific, in a different section, correct?
Well, I don't want to belabor it, but I'm just trying to.
We have, Burroughs, do you want to testify?
No, thank you.
And, Gary Roberts, yep, and I have one hearing that I'd like to complete before we lose our quorum, and I don't think it'll take too long for Senate Bill 334. So, Gary, Robert, do you want to say a few words?
Just briefly, Your Honor.
Yeah.
I'm Gary Roberts. I'm Deputy Director of Montgomery County Legal Aid. I also represent the Committee for Progress Through Law. I have only one concern about 269 as it's written, and then I would like to comment just briefly on Mr. Monroe's testimony about removing the residential landlord tenant problems from this act. My concern is that there's no private right of action for unconscionable tactics. And the reason why I think that is a major concern is that the Attorney General's office is fairly small. And Paul will be the first one to testify that when they get an individual complaint from a person, all they do is refer it over to Wanda Merrill. But their sole purpose, and correctly so, I'm not criticizing this, it's the way it has to be because of their small staff, they get involved when there's a pattern or practice or a scheme of unconscionable tactics or bilking the public or consumers. They don't get involved in individual complaints. So if we have a situation, and I think that it does exist, otherwise the Justice Division wouldn't be bringing this bill, where people are getting hurt by unconscionable tactics, individuals are not going to have a remedy whatsoever, because Paul and his staff is only going to get involved if it is a widespread scheme. I would suggest that probably the same private right of action ought to exist for unconscionable problems as opposed to some of the other. I think that, in a way, it's putting priorities backwards when you say that there's a private right of action if business can solicit potential customers by telephone or door-to-door and doesn't within 30 seconds at the beginning of the conversation identify himself and who he represents and the purpose of his call. That, if you don't do that, there's a private right of action, but if you act unconscionably, that is willfully and knowingly, willfully and knowingly take advantage of a customer's physical infirmity, ignorance, illiteracy, or inability to understand the language of the agreement, there is no private right of action, no remedy for an individual who's been wronged. It seems to me that I would think that second category, unconscionability, is a bigger problem and deserves a more effective remedy than some that already exist. And then maybe we ought to create a private right of action there too. I would point out that in order to have a private right of action, you've got to prove not only that these things occurred knowingly, which the language on page 3, but also that these acts were done willfully. Willfully already presently exists as a requirement before you can bring any action under the Kentucky Safe Act. That's a pretty stiff test. I guess I would like to then also turn to the notion of the problem of a landlord-tenant. We have no problem conceptually with bringing all of the landlord-tenant rights and remedies under the same statute. But I would like to...
The one that it's under now or under this?
Well, there is a difference between the rights and remedies under the Separate Trade Practice and what exists under the Landlord-Tenant Act. And so if you could move what would exist under the Separate Trade Practice Act and put it under 91, we would have no problem. But I would, if, let me recite briefly the fact of the case I tried 2 years ago. Two college women, age 21 or 22, rented an apartment, for $160 a month. And it was in the Portland State area, and they wanted to be married close to the classes. And they went, and they went to the landlord, and the landlord said, well, I realize that the plumbing isn't hooked up now, and you can't use the toilets now, but you're not going to move in for 2 weeks. And I realize you don't have any hot water now, but I'll get that all fixed up before you move in 2 weeks. And so they paid the first and last month's rent in a fairly large security deposit, and they checked back about 4 or 5 days before they were going to move in. He says, well, my listing, they're going to work on it tomorrow. They'll take care of it, no problem, don't worry about it. They moved in, still haven't been taken care of. They're going to be on it the next day, day after day. And these ladies had to go down the street to a restroom to brush their teeth and to go to the bathroom and do all those kind of things. They never were getting hot water. And about a month later, after they'd been struggling around, they finally came to our office and we filed a lawsuit. We got the maximum damages that Judge Jones felt that he was authorized to give under law. They got all of their 2 months rent back. He realized that the fair rental value of that unit was zero. And so they got the 2 months rent back and they got the security deposit back. In fact, they got twice the security deposit. That was the only penalty we could pick up. Plus, they got cost with some attorney fees on top of that. But here was a man who had, it appeared to Judge Jones, had deliberately rented this place out to these people, said, I'm going to provide you with the services necessary to live here, and hadn't done so. Judge Olson ruled, and this was his ruling when he was presiding judge, the Kentucky Trade Practices Act applied to the rental situation. Judge Ross, the current presiding judge, has ruled differently. So there is a mix about what judges have to say. But the remedy for these people who very clearly have been the victim of deceptive promises, which I think Section 2 and probably EFG&I of the current act would apply to, had a very small remedy under the Landlord-Tenant Act. There was no $200 deterrent. There was no possibility of punitive damages, even though I think that they were called for in this type of case. All I'm saying really is that from time to time, there is value in having that sort of remedy available for a tenant in a specially egregious situation. I would urge that if we delete residential landlord-tenant problems out of the Kentucky Trade Practices Act, I have no problem with that, but a similar type remedy be put in for that form of really bad conduct in ORS 91.
Okay, any questions? If not, thank you, Jerry.
Thank you.
Our last witness, George Burney, with Apartment House Association. George? You can get your point as quickly as possible because we'd like to. I know we don't have too much time left. I think that there's some that have 3 seconds.
I tell you, very short.
Okay.
We agree that I represent the Oregon Apartment Association of some
owners of 1,000 apartment houses throughout the state, which feel that the landlord-tenant law, which is the legislative body passed in 1973 and amended in 75 and will probably amend again in 77, is the proper vehicle for handling the situation between landlord and tenant on a residential basis. It's true that, as Mr. Monroe says, that all the remedies available in that act are not in the act covered by the bill, subject bill, are not available in the landlord-tenant law. And if they should be, I think they could probably be introduced and we could consider it in view of the fact of the many burdens under which the parties now operate. So we think the bill should be amended to exclude residential landlord-tenant relations.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, George. Are there any further questions? Any questions? Now, thank you. I'd like to quickly do. Jan, if you can work with the superintendent banks and others, I will also serve with you on this. Be a member of your subcommittee, if that's all right. You feel less personal.
Okay, let's go to
Senate Bill 334. Lyle still well with the elevator industry. I think we've heard this one before, Wally.
Haven't we? Pardon? I think we're familiar. Chairman, member of the committee. I'm Lyle Stilwell of Portland Elevator Company, and I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 334, a bill compiled by a committee from the elevator industry representing both labor and management. The primary intent of the bill is to ensure that installation, repair, modification, and maintenance of elevators is performed by competent mechanics. The bill has the facility for training and licensing an elevator mechanic within the elevator trade. This license will be given in lieu of the existing limited electrical license, which in fact covers only 25% of the elevator work. The remaining 75% of elevator work is mechanical. All of the primary safety devices are mechanical and are required by safety standards to function in case of a power failure. We feel any law or regulation that is enacted by a governing body relating to the elevator industry is for the safety and well-being of the public. Therefore, we look forward to implementing Senate Bill 334 to license the whole man dealing with all the facets of the elevator industry, not just the electrical work, which constitutes only 25%.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Yes, Senator Carson.
Not to be argumentative, but would you mind restating what the need is for how many people have been killed or injured or in Oregon as a result of our failure to license as it's described?
We have had very few deaths in the elevator industry. Historically, if you take the whole nation, it's probably the best form of transportation. However, there have been a few deaths involved with elevators. We have one, I believe, located at the Weyerhaeuser Mill in Springfield. We have had a couple of deaths in Seattle that don't relate here, but they were involved with people other than elevator people that were doing things with elevators.
And the injuries were a direct result of bad maintenance
or misuse of the equipment by inexperienced people.
Okay, thank you.
Are you
too,
Wally?
Yes, thank you.
Yes, thank you.
It's a green elevator, but has the same terminology, but means something else. In common Oregon, and it happens to have an elevator to get workmen to the top of the green elevator. Did they come under the auspices of this bill?
Yes, all of the elevators, all of the licensed elevators presently in the state of Oregon would come under this bill.
Whether they are used by the public or not.
That's correct.
Well, I could buy this concept a lot easier if working elevators were excluded.
But isn't that workman's life valued the same as yours or mine if we were to be riding in that elevator?
If the heat is there, knows it, has lived in it, exceeding the expenses, I don't know where the first licensed elevator operator would be from Condon, Oregon. It would be a long way.
Well, we presently run maintenance routes into Pendleton. We service the hospital there.
Okay, the grain harvest is on. Something went wrong with that. You have to go to the top. How long would you be there?
Well, it would require the time for us to get there physically.
And it wouldn't take much to fix.
Well, that's something that there would be no way to actually determine that. Suppose that it were a complex problem.
Well, if you couldn't fix it, why would you find it was complex enough? Like, of course, you'd have to have some help. But if it's something fairly simple, sure it's a pain in the neck to the operators of such a business enterprise to have to wait until a qualified licensed man comes out of Portland or Pendleton on your regular run into the area.
Well, we make emergency runs.
How much would it cost?
Well, that would depend on the distance he travels. We are regulated by union regulation for mileage and travel time.
The
other states license in this way?
Some of the other states do, some of them do not. We are already licensed through the electrical, and that only relates to about 25% of the industry. In fact, the overall industry would say 20%. And so we are already subject to a licensing.
Every state license, at least some?
No.
The electrical part? No?
No.
State of Oregon. Do you know that states that do have licensing procedures, let's say as comprehensive as this one would be, have any lesser rate of accident or death because of the licensing?
I
don't know for sure
whether
licensing really affects safety or not.
Well, let me within the framework of that, you would some device in your home, you would desire a competent man to work on it. So, if there are competent people working on it, the licensing becomes immaterial. If there is some method of ensuring the fact that it is a competent man doing and performing the work.
Okay. What you're saying is that 20 to 25% of the actual work on the elevator is electrical, the rest is mechanical.
That's right.
You're qualified to do both. Your people, your mechanics are qualified to do both electrical and mechanical.
That's right.
If there could be something, for example, wrong with that elevator that would cause circuit to go out, circuit breaker to go out, and it could be mechanical.
Yes. In fact, the primary safety devices, the devices that grip the rails and hold the car in case of a free fall or an overspeed condition, are mechanical. The device that tips those is a governor that operates on centrifugal force, is mechanical. The locks that keep the doors from being opened when the elevator is not there, that is a mechanical latch. The buffers that, in case all else fails, the buffers in the pit are mechanical. The brake, in fact, is lifted electrically to run
been set mechanically to stop. So in case of a power failure, all of the safety devices are required by the standard to perform.
Do, are any of these elevators in factories, such as grain elevators, are they inspected by you people now, or are there any?
Well, we would not perform the inspection.
I mean,
the elevator in, from the Department of Commerce are presently, yes, on a yearly basis, to be licensed.
Do they check all that equipment for?
Yes, I say yes because the ones that we are involved with, I'm sure they do, and I'm sure that the state inspector could testify the same.
Are there any further questions? If not, thank you very much. And Russ Wagner with the elevator constructor.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Gentlemen, my name is Russ Wagner. I'm a representative for the elevator constructors, Local Union 23 in Portland, Oregon. I appeared before you in support of Senate Bill 334. The elevator to the trade consists of about 75% mechanical, 25% electrical, and persons who install, repair, or service elevators in the state of Oregon should be qualified to do so. These people should be competent in all phases of the elevator trade and be certified as such before attempting to install, repair, or service equipment they are unfamiliar with. Standards for the elevator trade in Oregon may be found in the American National Standard Safety Code for Elevators, which is written and published by mechanical engineers. That is the standards for the state of Oregon now. I believe that all persons entering the elevator trade should be tested in not only the electrical portion, as is now the case, but in all phases of the trade. And I would answer anything I could in that regard. I thank you.
Thank you, Russ. Are there any questions for any member of the committee?
Okay. How are we going to train and prepare these people to certify?
Well, at the present time, and for the past 10 years, the elevator industry has a training program researched, developed, printed, and in fact, all phases are subject to their approval. All mechanics are subject to their approval.
Mm-hmm.
Their tests are standard tests over the United States now. All local people who ply the elevator trade under the elevator constructors, local union cards, must be mechanically and electrically tested to date by a national exam, which in my estimation, the program is a good one. It's a mandatory program now.
This is already in effect.
This is in effect.
So why do you need to certify them?
The certification, because of the mandatory problems we have within the trade, doesn't mean necessarily that the work is necessarily being done by competent people. And right now, today, there are servicing elevators in department stores, in industrial plants, where they are using an electrical license under the guise of a competent person. And all I'm asking is for those people who are working under those conditions to be at least tested to their condition of qualification in all aspects of the trade. We're not asking for any special treatment that we haven't already done or for ourselves, but we are asking for the state of Oregon to be in the same category as our own people. Now, we, if there's anything else.
Once certified, are you always certified?
Yes. Unless we're away from the trade 2 years, and then we would have to recertify.
What about new developments?
This is the idea of being a manager within the trade. You would be
kept up to date on new developments. The training program is updated periodically, and I say this would probably be...
But once certified, you don't need to be retrained, do you?
No, no, but you, if, unless you're away from the trade. If you're away from the trade for any longer period than 2 years, you would have to recertify.
Looks to me like you'd want to keep your certified people retrained.
Right, absolutely. And we are, in fact, asking, it isn't mandatory, but we're asking for any anyone that wishes to sit in our classes in our training program that are mechanics and are certified now as mechanics may sit in on and keep their job current, which is really what we're after.
Are you going to grandfather any people in?
Yes, all those people under this bill who are working now at the elevated trade in any manner, whether they be under the union card that I cover, or whether they're under the electrical card that some of the industrial plants now are covering, will be grandfathered in if they are certified as elevator electrical licensed elevator repairmen now. In other words, right now we are covering ourselves with the electrical department, and it is the license reads elevator electrical journeyman.
Seems to me like if you're grandfathering all those people in without them, you know, going through the rigorous requirements for certification that you need, that you're likely to get those incompetents just grandfathered in.
I'm not saying that we aren't, because I think that this was a point that we talked about and knew that we did not want to make a hardship on anyone who was currently working on elevators and appeared to be competent to those employers that were giving them work. But we wanted to make sure that any additional people that they take on would be, in fact, competent in the eyes of the industry and of the people that they are serving. Now, we're talking about public people.
And any way of getting at the ones you grandfather in to make sure that they all have the training that the new ones would have?
Absolutely none within the plants who are not subject to our own agreement to the elevator constructors. But this, I suppose, would be determined by their ability to either sign agreements with us so that they could partake in our training program, which is a national program, but I cannot hold this program out for all those outside of our industry. That would be, you know, prohibitive when they have, in fact, spent the money to bring this program about. And so, to that degree, yes, they could make themselves available with it under certain conditions, but it would have to be through an agreement with us.
Okay.
Senator Carson? I take it that it's your feeling that there are incompetent elevator repairmen working in Oregon at the present time?
Without a doubt, there are. And I say this, probably the facts could be verified very easily. One might point out that whenever an elevator gets to the point that the maintenance man in the particular case, whether it be a retail outlet downtown, a retail store who has elevators they're servicing, cannot do the job or cannot find the problem, they always invariably call an elevator contractor. That's the last resort in most cases where they are servicing their own cars. And I say any major repair is generally farmed out to an elevator contractor. They never do their own cabling. I will say that it doesn't really affect us that much within the trade as far as the work is concerned, but we are concerned that those cars are not looked at by competent people. They're not sure of what they're going after when they repair a car. And I know that you take it for granted that when you climb on that car, that it's in a safe condition. The state label says it is. And I would only like to assure you people and anyone else in the state of Oregon that when you climb in a car with a permit on it, that it is safe. And it has been looked at by people who know the business.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Thank you.
We have, you want to testify? Oh.
I did not. I apologize to the committee. I did not introduce the amendment.
Oh, okay. They're considering we have them here, and we'll consider the amendment. We'll probably have to have another meeting, a work session on this bill, regardless. So, if it's possible for you to come down, and we will notify you. Do you have their address, Connie?
Mr. Stillwell
and Russ Wagner. You give their address, and Bob Stanfield. To give leave their name, and when we have a work session on this, we'll invite you down and you can offer the amendments at that time. In the meantime, we have them, and we appreciate it, Lyle. Because we've lost our quorum, some of the members have other committee meetings, and Senator Troll and I are the only, what we call the old faithfuls here. Other young people.
You're about to be the last one.
And Senator Troy has to go for the book, and I have another meeting too. So we have four witnesses: Tom Donica, Tom Hooten, Len Gregor with Crown Fellow Bank, and Mr. Schlesner with the Oregon Association of Hospitals, Mr. Hooten from Weyerhaeuser, and Tom Donica with Associated with industry.
Bill Whitaker, in understanding your problem, we're all talking about the state. I understand that, Senator, but the two people, Mr. Hooten and Mr. Gregor, have come from a fair distance, and I think they ought to be heard today.
I'm glad you told me that. Would you please come forward to Mr. Gregor and Mr. Hooten? And can you both come up here at the same time? And I mean, the Weyerhaeuser and Crown Federal Bank still. Or communicate with one another or you're a student. You're doing it. See, I've worked for both companies at one time or another. I worked at the Westland Hill when I was then I worked for Weyerhaeuser. I was a radio operator in one of your steamships at one time. A lot of
Senator and members of the committee, my name is Tom Hooten. I live at 2250 Greenbrier Street, Springfield, Oregon. I'm employed by the Weyerhaeuser Company, Paperboard Division, in Springfield as electrical supervisor in charge of all electrical maintenance and repairs in Paperboard Division. I've held this position for 13 and a half years. I have an Oregon State General Journeyman's license since 1952, a manufacturing plant electrical supervisor's license since 1963. I have a staff of 18 licensed electricians, 16 of whom are licensed journeymen, and 2 licensed apprentices. These 18 people represent a total of 298 years of experience in the electrical trade. Our mechanical maintenance department is much larger and represents many more years of experience than this. Our plant has been in operation since 1949, and we have a very small turnover in our maintenance department. In our plant, we have 13 pieces of equipment that would be covered by this proposed bill. Some of this equipment is still placed in our manufacturing process, but its continuous operation is essential to the total operation of that department. Our plant maintenance personnel has historically maintained this equipment since its installation, some dating back to 1949. This equipment is annually inspected by a state elevator inspector, and all safety requirements are maintained in good working order. If I understand Senate Bill 334, our plant personnel would no longer be able to maintain this equipment. This could be quite costly to my company, with very little, if anything, to show for it in the way of increased safety. For example, in our paper machine rooms, they have roller-loading elevators, which takes the finished rolls of paper from our operating floors, where we have very little storage area, to the shipping docks below, where these rolls are immediately loaded into boxcars. These elevators fail, they must be repaired quickly, or the entire department must be shut down. I'm sure that the intent of this bill is to ensure the public that the elevators which they use both to ride in and to handle freight and equipment on are being installed and maintained by qualified people. I firmly believe that our personnel are qualified to maintain our equipment. We do not perform any installations of new elevators as outlined in this bill. I urge you to consider our position in this matter. I would like to comment, Mr. Stillwell mentioned a facility at Warehouse of Springfield that was a facility on a man lift, and it has, was in no way connected with the improper maintenance of the equipment.
Well, Mr. Whitney, you heard testimony that it's qualified electrically, but only 20 to 25% of the work on the elevator is electrical, the rest is mechanical. Are you men trained mechanically? If so, and you're qualified, why don't you become a licensed elevator mechanic? Would it be impossible to do so? Why don't you license your people as certified elevator mechanic?
I believe it's not been required that they be certified. I believe
this is all we're, I think it's all we're asking to do. You know, what would be wrong about if you know what you're you know, if you know what you're doing and you're capable, why don't you agree to the bill and certainly, if you're people that qualified, they could become qualified, certified elevator mechanics.
I think our people certainly are qualified, and I'm not sure what it would take for them to become certified. I'd have to study that situation.
Well, I'll comment on that. I think the difference is that all of the electricians who are licensed do all of the electrical work, but not all of the mechanics would do the mechanical work on the lift. In other words, do you have, didn't we have licensed or qualified elevator mechanics, and where did they receive their training? And
I mean, they have a 4-year apprenticeship program that they move through, and they're tested both.
Yeah, with Crown?
Crown Government, right. And
they're not with White House.
Well, I think they're a program similar, but I couldn't speak for it.
Yes, we have the state electrical apprenticeship program, which has the...
Well, let me ask you this. Didn't you have an electrician and also a mechanic? You have two staff that work in that elevator. You have an electrician that takes care of the wiring. Then you have a mechanic also that does the mechanical work, the brakes and whatever is to do with a mechanical operation elevator.
Most of our staff...
I guess the electrician do it all.
No. Electricians do the electrical, mechanical, and railroad people do the mechanical. We also have hydraulic elevators, which are pipefitters, do the hydraulic. Our man lifts, our carpenters get involved in the man lifts, slicing belts, that sort of thing. So we have a very good class.
We have the
mechanical man, he's very qualified to work on it, and the electrical man, the two of them work together. We do not have any hydraulic elevators.
Do you want to give your testimony?
Right. Okay. My name is Dan Gregory, and with Crown Government in West Bend, Oregon. I'm a plant engineer and responsible for our maintenance, and I've been in this thing for 14 years. We have 11 elevators as a freight pipeline and product, raw material and machinery. And we operate 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, typical of most process industries. We're down in the on July the 4th, Labor Day, and Christmas. That's the operate on New Year's Day, Washington's birthday, Lincoln's birthday, Easter, Memorial Day, Veterans Day, and Thanksgiving. I read Senate Bill Proposal 334, and I'm here to testify in opposition to it. It would require that any mechanic can install, alter, repair, and maintain an elevator unless he is a certified mechanic or who does this work under the immediate supervision of a certified editor and mechanic. To become a certified editor and mechanic, you must have worked a minimum of 2 years regularly in the installation, alteration, repair, or maintenance of an elevator, directly preceding the application for such certification. Our mechanics who are now competent and capable of performing repairs and maintenance would be unable to qualify and would be idled. Our electricians are currently licensed to work on elevators. This bill is satisfactory for those who are in the business of installation, altering, repairing, or maintenance of elevators. The public can call for such service of unknown personnel and the field screened and unknown to them can feel a reasonable degree of assurance, but certainly not a positive one, that a safe and competent job is done. However, applied to industry and business which are maintenance personnel, this bill would cause hardship and shutdown of operations at considerable loss to the employees and the company. For example, for an elevator malfunction, we would have to shut down departments that handle paper products to the shipping level. There'd be no question about that. Number two, we would have to call in a certified man with a costly delay time. This is not practical. These men are not readily available, and we would expend delays of weeks to get all elevated people in to do a job. I definitely feel any acceptable response on a 24-hour basis on holidays is not realistic. And when you couple this with a vacation, sickness, and absentee situation, it illustrates the actual situation which we could not accept. Being close to Portland is one thing, but I started to think of the plant with an elevator problem in a remote part of the state. Number three, we would shut down if the elevator industry were in state. And four, we would have to idle our mechanics capable of doing this work and added expense to the company and a demoralizing situation for now. We have competent people to do our maintenance. They are supervised by personnel who have developed preventive maintenance programs and who are aware of the public safety requirements for elevators. And I have the details of those preventive maintenance programs if you find you have time to take a look at them. We do want and must have the assurance that we can utilize our own mechanics to maintain this equipment. This is the way that presently is being done in our service. Plant ability to make repairs will result in a far more safer installation than that foreseen in this bill. So we have a shift morale and a shift electrician on the clock, 24 hours a day. They're available by the radio, they carry orders that can be available there. That's the elevator problem in, say, within 5-10 minutes. And then fix it and repair it and run away. I recommend references to the mechanic certification in industry be removed from the bill.
Okay.
Okay.
If I understood your witness's testimony, he indicated that virtually everybody now servicing elevators is mechanics who began part of them. So if that's the case, now maybe I'm wrong. But if that's the case, then what kind of hardship do you operate under?
Well, I think what he's referring to is the term regularly servicing elevators.
Oh.
We are in the business of doing this as a commercial enterprise.
Just
a moment, Russ. I just want to see that. Directly employed in the installation, alteration, repair, or maintenance of an elevator under the immediate personal supervision of a certified elevator mechanic.
Okay.
Yeah, Russ, did you have something on that?
Well, this was never the intent to anybody that was working at the state now. They wanted to make sure that those that were going to come along were going to be certified as competent.
Oh, that's right. The amendments are here, and let's give him a.
I was just given a copy of the amendments just before I came in, but I have not had a chance.
I don't know. You do have a copy of the amendments.
You have a copy of the amendments.
Okay, well, that's fine.
I think the problem in ministry is that you may have 3 or 4 men who are particularly suited and like working in elevators and they volunteer to do this kind of work, and then we work with these people and develop a high degree of precision and suitability with those. So
let me ask you this. I've heard you say that that Crown Z was brought elevator mechanics in there and took 2 or 3 weeks to get them to work. Evidently, you need them at times then, if your own men is beyond the scope of your own men, right?
Oh, that's right. There are jobs that you do not want to do. You don't see that you want to do
elevator mechanics.
Yeah, it's a matter of judgment.
Which indicates that there are jobs as far as this elevator repair that are beyond the,
beyond the reasonable scope.
Yeah.
We just recently installed new safety gun on the machine elevator, and it was done by Montgomery elevator, and we did that for that. We would never tackle anything like that.
Why then, let me ask Russ, why does it take 2 or 3 weeks for you to get out of a job like that?
This is something that I wanted to bring up, but I didn't know how to approach it, but I'm sure the industry here could bear me out. There's never been a time when it took that kind of time to get an elevator man to do a call. Now, for a repair job, it's like anything else. It takes time to set up a time schedule for repair. Even parts have to come in for repair.
So you'd have to order the parts and whatnot.
But not on a call. The money to call for a shutdown car, I did a bit to differ with him because there's never been a time when it takes, I would say, more than the hours it takes to get a man from Portland to wherever.
Can the roof get one of your men in the middle of the night to order the parts they can call in the middle?
Absolutely.
All 24 hours a day.
24 hours a day with several companies, not just with one. There's 11 companies in Portland. Most of them do service. Most of them are on call 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. They all have this type of service. Some of them have service offices remote from Portland. They have offices in Salem, offices in Eugene, offices in Medford. That they are closer to the problem than maybe some of these people realize.
I think probably that would be the reason in the 2 or 3 week delay of this case that it could be a part if there was a bad breakdown where they would need parts or if it was a
problem. Well, you talked about a situation that has been proposed. I'm speaking from the situation as it is now. As it is now, if we want an elevator repair, we have had the reasons to get some help in it. No question about that.
Yes, but a repair job, an ordinary repair job, you have to wait weeks before you can get a repairman in there and call in one of the companies in Portland.
Right.
Well, this would again only be for parts. There's no need for any time scheduling for people. We realize that there are time schedules and
from
first come, first serve.
Well, let me ask you this. Most of the elevator repair companies and Mr. Steelwell, don't you maintain parts there?
Yes.
Would you maintain parts for elevators like they use in Crown 3, these big grip elevators?
Without knowing his particular equipment, I would say yes, because we maintain all mixed developments and we do have parts. However, if you were talking about the safety, we would not have those parts because that is a particular item that is rarely in from the date of installation. That would be what would be generally referred to as a modification of some extent. We service, being a little bit on time, we service most of the hospitals in the state. And they are very demanding of service. We service Penalty, we service over in the Bend area. Even up to Huffman, getting to the area that Benson. And the Eugene area, we service the hospitals there. They are as demanding or more so than any other type of elevator application.
I think the situation like that, you have an alternative because you have a story, but if you have a person tuned down and you're living every calendar rolls from the basement up the elevator to the machine, and that machine stays down, there's a penny of thousands of dollars to us for that delay.
Mm-hmm.
not going to be an untenable situation.
Of course, they have amended this bill to take care of that situation, as I understand it. Have you seen the amendments, Bill?
I have not had a chance to see them.
Tom Donahue, I see you shaking your head. Have you seen the amendment?
I have.
To cover?
I don't believe so.
Well, we're going to have a work session on this as soon as we can.
Could you address this if it were clear that your mechanics already on the job working for the electrician servicing the elevators could be certified? Would you then object to having to have them certified?
Yes, I will. And I'd like to.
Even if you're grandfathered in, you could have that.
Yeah. And I'll explain that. You have a crew of men, say you have 50 mechanics who are supposed to do this work, and now all of a sudden you must pick someone who will himself voluntarily be certified, and he'll have to take an examination, and you'll have to do one of these.
That isn't true. You're not under the terms of the bill. They won't have to take an examination if you're certified.
That's only if they're doing it now, but it's in the future, as I understand.
Yeah, in the future,
right.
Yeah, it's true.
So then, how do you get people to step forward from a crew of men and do this? You would almost have to pay them a premium and say, okay, to get you fired to do this, we'll pay an extra rate, which is an extra cost to us. The work would not be done better, it would not be done safer because we're doing it right now. And I think is the whole problem.
That's a bigger bet, and it's going to be more costly.
No, no, no. I mean, I'm saying it's almost an impractical situation because it's possible that nobody in the crew will say, I want to go and do an elevator mechanic on that basis. Thanks for not to pretend you're certified.
How do you know that?
I don't, but I'm saying it's possible that nobody's going to want to do that unless you provide some sort of motivation for him to step forward and take that.
And what you're saying is you just have to provide that motivation?
I'm saying that you can't take a few men in a crew and expect to get someone to step forward voluntarily and say, yeah, I'll do that work. You have a host of other factors. You have seniority to consider. You have all these things that you have to consider. Who's going to do the work? Whereas in the case of the electrician, they are all licensed, you see. So there's no problem. But when you try to select a few to step forward and do something like this.
Did you see anything in the bill on that? Russ, is there anything in that bill which would in the amendment that would prohibit him from certifying all of his electricians?
They're already certified.
I mean to certify them as mechanics.
If they are licensed under the state now, as elevator servicing, that's what primarily they were supposed to do, they would automatically be given new licenses under the new law. Now I understand, and I might as well bring it up, I understand they did not license these people as they were supposed to at state level, and have some of them now been working on their blue car electrical license, and never having had any mechanical work, they only work on that portion of electrical.
Even though they're required by law to have a license,
well, then, as the law states now, anyone with blue cars may work on elevators per se, the electrical portion. There has never been any law determining how much a man has to know about
the mechanical engine elevator before he can work on an elevator. Only the electrical portion has ever been managed. And they have allowed these car
electricians to work on an elevator under those conditions only.
Any further comment?
Question? Anything further? Mr. Chairman, I just might like to add one thing. I think our mail is probably, like most of the industry, we're really concerned with safety. We work very hard at it. We have a very active safety department. An elevator is one of the, in my humble estimation, it's one of the least complicated pieces of equipment that we work on. Our people are responsible for
extremely complicated high-speed equipment, and I just don't think we ought to be, and we're very confident in working at it. We have an excellent safety record, and I think this is an added burden, and it's almost an insult to our people to say that we should have a special license to work on this type of equipment.
I might just indicate in our preventive maintenance program, which is a planned program distributed through the 12 months of the year, we put out work orders on all the auditors for specific things, and we check these and include inspections, drives, belts, safety, cables, shifts, rails, cars, gates, safes, and the pits. And we check generator, motor brushes, and planners, contactors, relay units, switches, alignment, grounds, run checks on the control, and we also inspect electrical cables. Now, there's nothing mysterious about an auto control. It's just a series of relays and electrical gear, just like we have on our complicated electric tape machine drive. Usually static controls, and men are proficient at this. And they do this all the time. This is why we can troubleshoot an elevator with no problem. And we can make the repair. It's the same way with the mechanical people. They work on a lot of precise mechanical equipment that we have in a paper mill because our paper machines must run continuously unless they shut down for a specific maintenance interval and they get up and run again. So a lot of emphasis on dependability and safety, as you said. I mean, do a fine job at that, and we do a fine job on elevator maintenance. And we would like to continue to be able to do it that way with our own personnel. Len, did you have something to...
I just want to comment that if you don't operate an elevator, you must not run it.
If you do and there's an accident or injury, then they can, you can be sued.
Well, it's the law, if you don't run it.
Well, there have been employers that have run equipment when it has been red tagged. That's true.
This is correct, too.
Okay, if there's nothing further, we'll notify you of a work session on this. Bill, I'm sorry, Doctor. Dr. Peter Fleischer.
Thank you, sir.
With the Oregon Association of Hospitals. I've thought that you'd be one of those who live down here and come back at another time, like